This week on Writers, Inc.
I actually find the whole idea of what if so great to work with. And I sometimes when I'm teaching a writing class, which I don't do a lot of, but if I'm asked to speak like at the Writer's Digest or Thriller Writing Conference, I talk about what if, and I sometimes worry people think, God, that is so basic and simple. And yet it really is great because you take your imagination off the leash and you just keep going and going and going.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories, all have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, it's Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
I'm Jay Kevin Tomlinson.
I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. So how many coffee drinkers do we have here on the panel?
I am all the coffee drinkers.
Me.
Yeah. Is it physically possible to write a book without coffee?
No.
I don't think so.
You can do it, but what you get is is terrible.
There's a lot of dark sorcery involved if that's the case. Like, you've made some deals that you may regret making later.
You may not be able to.
That's my opinion.
I did it once, honestly. Like, my wife, when she was pregnant, she had to stop drinking coffee, or she wanted to stop. So like in support, I stopped drinking coffee. And I wrote The Fifth to Die. And I remember getting a phone call from my editor, and he like flat out asked me, like, do you have some kind of issue with coffee going on? And I asked him why. And apparently, like, I had an insane number of scenes with characters drinking coffee, like literally every meeting, every room. You know, like we had to cut like half of the coffee references in the book, and it was all subconscious.
Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah. And the book took me longer to write too. Not much. I mean, like another 4 or 5 weeks longer than normal, but it slowed me down.
I will confess, I have a bad habit of anytime I need two characters to do a little bit of, you know, exposition on the sly, they're usually drinking coffee.
Well, yeah, because they can zip coffee, they can put their cup down, they can pick up their cup, they can do this.
Exactly.
Do mm-hmm. Yeah. Gives you some fodder to play with.
Yeah. 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 It's a bit like having one of those fidget spinners or something, you know.
With coffee. Well, enough coffee will make you need a fidget spinner. But that's also probably very like good for typing, you know, just manically getting the words on the keyboard.
Oh, yeah.
Although I don't know, I think I'm so far gone with coffee. Like, I don't know that it actually gives me energy anymore as much as just like brings me to life and like just maintains a certain level that is a necessity at this point.
I don't think that the caffeine has any impact on me at all anymore, but I love coffee. I'm a black coffee drinker. Like that's what I want.
Same.
And this whole conversation started because before we revved up, I was talking about how I thought I would cheat. And if I wanted like a quick cup of coffee, I bought these little like Folgers packs that are like tea bags. And they're awful. Like, they're so bad. I even tried putting milk in it, and somehow that just made it worse. Like, they're just.
That's like the coffee you get in the hotel room. Any of you ever drink that? I don't think I've ever once opened those.
Yeah, it's bad.
It looks horrible.
I will go out and, you know, or go down to the restaurant and get coffee and bring it up because no.
I will fully admit I am so addicted to coffee that I absolutely do drink those because I don't even think I could make it to the downstairs coffee without like that initial injection of terrible coffee. I may need like a 12-step program at this point.
That's the coffee that fuels you in going to find coffee.
I can picture Jenna on the bathroom floor snorting the coffee grounds from the hotel room.
Yeah.
Leave me alone.
I find I drink more coffee though when I'm writing on the weekends. Like, I make a whole pot every day, which I don't know why. There's only two of us that drink coffee. And on the weekdays when I'm at work, there's still half a pot. But when I'm at home writing on the weekends, like, the whole pot is gone. And then sometimes I need to make a second one.
Well,
I don't know why that is.
We make, there's two people that drink coffee in this house. We make a full pot and drink it every day. And we upgraded to an espresso machine. And so, yeah, there's usually a early afternoon espresso added to the mix now. So
I like how you enunciated it. Espresso. Not, well, not espresso like everyone I grew
espresso.
Up with.
Espresso. Yeah. Espresso. Yeah, we feel very Italian, very, you know, it's very, we're easing into a, turning into European expats at some point in our life.
Love it.
All right, Kevin, what is in the news?
Lots of interesting things in the news. So first up, a sad bit. Nobel laureate Alice Munro has died. Alice Munro, a Canadian short story writer and winner of the 2013 Nobel Prize for Literature, has died at the age of 92. The CEO of Penguin Random House Canada, Kristen Cochran, said, "Alice Munro is a national treasure, a writer of enormous depth, empathy, and humanity, whose work is read, admired, and cherished by readers throughout the world." Very sad, but 92, I think if I got to go, 92 is a target.
That's not bad. I don't know about, cause I'm Canadian. I don't know about you all, but I've read a lot of Alice Munro. So I was like, I'm a fan. So it's 92, but still sad. Yeah. I don't know. The great jelly from her story, Menace Tongue, still haunts me. So that's a good one for anyone who wants to
get. Is that 92 in Canadian years or American years?
I'm pretty sure they're the same. Oh, okay. I'm not sure. There's a half hour in Newfoundland we might lose somewhere. Depends where you're from.
I'm terrible. I honestly, like, I heard this and I saw it pop up everywhere, and then I had to actually look her up because I don't read short stories, so like I didn't know who she was.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's definitely, if you can get to 92 and you're still writing, like, you know, kudos for sure.
Absolutely.
My intention is for them to find me hunched over dead with like pencils taped to my palsied fingers in front of my keyboard.
Coffee in your hand.
Freshly ground coffee off to my left. That's how I want to go. So
the Word Slinger podcast, the music playing in the back.
the final Word Slinger podcast. I just clutch my chest and fall over on screen. The trial, the DOJ's suit to block Penguin Random House's acquisition of Simon & Schuster. This is coming out of Publishers Marketplace. They sent out a reminder, contrary to the viral information, it's not true that half of the books published sell fewer than 12 copies. Go figure. The stat, in quotes, comes from a misreading of a bit of questioning from a lawyer during the DOJ's trial to keep Penguin Random House from acquiring Simon & Schuster. In reality, about 15% of books sell fewer than 12 copies, while 1% exceed 50,000 sales. The largest percentage sell between 1,000 to 5,000 copies. And we're hoping JD's book is selling much more than 5,000 copies at Target.
I know I'm somewhere in the middle. I'm over 5,000 for sure. So I'm definitely not in that first group. I mean, I just can't even imagine, you know, only 12 copies. But I guess, you know, there's, I don't know what they've gotten that sample group. Like, is that indie authors that are just putting it out there and not marketing and selling to friends and family? Like, are they part of that group? Because that would make sense.
I think so.
Because like I think in the traditional world, it's like physically impossible to sell just 12 copies because they print X number and they ship them out. And, you know, like it's not going to be that low. But these are all stats from the trial. Like this is all old data, right? Like, I guess it's just being rehashed.
Yeah, I think this is a response to Al Griffin's article, though, that we talked about a couple episodes ago. And they're saying that that's a misreading of what the lawyer said. So they're saying that's just, you know, not true in any kind of circumstances. And then, of course, I think they have ulterior motives because they're like, we wrote a book about the DOJ trial, so come buy it. But, you know.
All right. The plot thickens.
Yeah.
The plot thickens. But yeah, I think they were just trying to correct that because that article went viral. And they're going, nah, that's not true, which is kind of what we were talking about last time.
Yeah.
We'll have to dial back and go back and listen to that episode. But I think we were all kind of like, yeah, there's something not quite right with the numbers, but I don't doubt at all that the numbers are skewed, like the numbers that we see regularly, or no, maybe rather it's what we sort of think the numbers are going to be is probably way off.
Yeah.
You know, just because it hit the New York Times list or something doesn't mean it sold like a million copies. So, except for JD's book, which did.
We've talked about the New York Times list before. Like, that is like, nobody really knows how that works. I mean, for the most part, it's a poll, you know, like they go out to the bookstores and then, you know, the bookstores, they give them a list and these are the books we think are going to be on the list this week. And like the bookstores have the ability to change that and they can write something in. But like, it's really not based on like actual sales numbers. It's not based on something tangible that like you think it would be. The USA Today one, as far as I know, is like the most accurate because it takes everything into account, you know, eBooks, audiobooks, print books, and it's actually based on real sales data. But, New York Times has always been a mystery.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And will remain so. here's what's not a mystery. AI is going to be in the news. That's no mystery. And here's the first of two stories we have about AI, but OpenAI destroyed a trove of books used to train AI models. The employees who collected the data are gone. Dun, dun, dun. Okay. OpenAI admitted in court filings that it had deleted two large data sets, Books 1 and Books 2, respectively, which were used to train the GPT-3 AI model. These data sets are said to have contained more than 100,000 published books, which are central to the Author Guild's allegation of copyright infringement. The Authors Guild has been persistently seeking details about these data sets, which OpenAI initially resisted sharing due to confidentiality concerns. Eventually, OpenAI disclosed that all copies of the data sets had been deleted, which has been a point of contention in the ongoing lawsuit. The deleted data sets comprised 16% of the training data for GPT-3, amounting to approximately 50 billion words, or one Kevin Tomlinson book, indicating extensive use of book data in AI training. OpenAI has faced challenges regarding the privacy of its former employees who developed these data sets, with the company requesting the court to keep their identities confidential. Oh, OpenAI.
Well, I think that they also, those employees don't even work for them anymore. Right. So like they deleted a bunch of stuff, got rid of the people who were working on it, and then are like, oh, we don't really need to give you their names or talk about it because everything's perfectly legitimate and legal and on the up and up.
Yeah.
Nothing to see here.
They may even be protected in revealing the names of those people from employment agreements and other HR related things. I'm not sure.
As far as I know, there's no real recourse though, right? Like there was websites you could go to before and you could search to see if your titles were part of these couple of data sets. And I know I had like three or four books that were in there. But you know, aside from that, like, I don't know what else you can really do. And I'm guessing they deleted the data after they used the data. So, you know, they didn't need it anymore. It was basically throwing away the research material. The damage was already done, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's no like closing Pandora's box, but I do think that part of the trial, and I could be completely wrong, but I think that some of it is just to even say, well, maybe they deserve some sort of payment to the authors whose information they use as part of the training. I don't know what that would look like or how they would even like calculate that. I don't know. It's an interesting problem.
Mm-hmm. 50 billion words gone, though. Yeah, that's my worst nightmare.
I'm sure we'll hear more about it as the court case goes on. So
yeah,
we'll keep an eye out for that.
And then someone will generate an AI book about it, and Netflix will turn that book into a series. Final story. Hello, GPT-4.0. OpenAI has announced GPT-4.0, O as in Omni, by the way, that's a lowercase o, a new AI model capable of understanding and generating content across multiple modalities, including text, audio, images, and video in real time. Users can communicate in real time via live voice conversation, video streams from your phone, and text. Most impressive is its facility with live conversation. You can interrupt the model during its responses and it will stop, listen, and adjust course. It can reason through visual problems via video in real time as well. And the model is rolling out over the next few weeks and will be free for all users through both the GPT app and the web interface, according to the company. I have played with this, by the way, and this is it's scary cool is what it is, but I can't wait to see the full rollout of it. But like interacting with this thing via voice was pretty interesting. And if you watch the demos, there's tons of demos about this. Go on YouTube, just type something in, but tons of demos about this, and it's like having a conversation with a real person. And if you ever saw the film Her with Joaquin Phoenix is his name, it's like that. It's exactly like that, except maybe it's not falling in
madness,
love with you.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I had an author friend was showing me how they were using it yesterday, fed in their old cover for a book, fed in a new one, and said, which one is better for my genre? Look at these K-lytics, tell me why, and gave it an opinion on why the new cover was better with all kinds of rationale. He shared that with me, and I'm just like, that is really interesting.
Yeah.
So it's going to be interesting to see how this evolves and what people use it for.
Did it seem like it was right? Like in its response? Like
I think, yeah, I agree. I was like, that makes a lot of sense. And it gave lots of reasoning why it was hitting the genres and which parts were on genre and which weren't, and went through a whole ton of reasoning and came up with an answer. And I'm like, that's pretty
cool.
One of the
demos that blew my mind the most was when the guy was, he's pretending like he told the AI he was going on an interview with OpenAI for a job, and he turns on the camera and she laughs and makes fun of his hair and his shirt and everything and says, you know, you might consider dressing, you know, maybe running your fingers through your hair and cleaning up a little. And then he says, well, I'm thinking about wearing this hat. And he puts on one of those like floppy fishing hats. And she laughed again.
Yeah.
She says, like, well, maybe not the best idea for this interview. I mean, it was like talking to my wife. It was bizarre. Bizarre.
Wow. It's evolving so fast. It's just mind-blowing. Yeah.
This stuff is kind of starting to creep out there. My wife sent me – I've got CarPlay in the car. So if anybody's got that, if you get a text message, your car basically reads you that message out loud. And typically if somebody sent a picture, like if my wife sent me a picture, it would just say that, you know, so-and-so sent an image as part of the text. But I got one the other day from her, and I read the text message, and it said, this is accompanied by an image of a child in a car seat sleeping. So like it looked at the image and basically told me what was in the, like, that kind of really freaked me out. It felt very voyeuristic. It almost like there was an intruder in our lives kind of thing. It wasn't something I opted into. It just, you know, I just noticed that it changed. So this is slowly creeping out there. I'm waiting for Amazon, my Alexa to start talking back to me and you know, some of these other things to start.
That's coming.
It's coming.
That's definitely coming. Yeah.
I'm surprised it hasn't happened yet.
Yeah. I did see, which Jenna, you may or may not be happy about, that OpenAI is planning to announce a Google search competitor, I think the day that we release this. So maybe you'll get a better search engine. I don't know.
Yeah, I guess if it fixes Google or turns into the new Google.
Yeah.
I just want a search engine that works like Google used to. That's all I want.
We'll see.
I have to admit, awesome. I like this whole development. I know we're headed towards the end of humanity as we know it and Skynet and all that, but I can't wait until I can have an actual conversation with AI about things, and it feels like a conversation instead of just, you know. Here's one thing that will happen right now with the current version is if you start a conversation with it, it's an endless series of questions. So as it answers whatever you asked, it'll ask you like, well, what do you think about this? Or what do you do? And it will never, ever stop. It's like getting in a conversation with my neighbor.
Perfect.
When you're writing a book, the first draft is the easy part. It's what comes after that hurts. The confusion, the self-doubt, questioning this, questioning that, trying to get feedback so you can feel confident making changes. It's a lot to handle. And that's why I'm delighted to say that this episode of the Writers Inc. podcast is sponsored by AutoCrit. One of the most value-packed memberships for any author, AutoCrit brings you an amazing suite of tools that can make it a breeze to plan, write, and edit your books all in one place. From start to finish, everything you need to produce a strong, confident story is at your fingertips. Get instant developmental feedback on plot, conflict, characters, themes, and more through the Story Analyzer. And edit each sentence to perfection with a complete interactive editing suite packed with reports and insights. And that's not to mention additional benefits like private community forums and live members-only support and writing sessions every single week. It's an incredible place to be for any writer. And listeners of the Writers Inc. podcast can take advantage of lifetime AutoCrit Pro membership for one single payment. That's right, no renewal fees. Head to autocrit.com/JD to get yourself a lifetime membership now. Big thanks to AutoCrit for sponsoring the show.
Oh, and on that, JD, who is up this week?
This week, we've got Kate White coming back. Kate White's the New York Times bestselling author of 12 murder mysteries and thrillers, as well as several nonfiction books. Her latest is called The Last Time She Saw Him, and it released on May 14th. Here she is, Kate White.
Welcome back.
Thank you. So nice to be back and talking to you again.
Yeah, you as well. I'm excited to talk about your new book. So your new book is called The Last Time She Saw Him, and it starts with Kiki Reed seeing her ex for the first time at a party after she's broken off the engagement, and then he dies.
Yeah.
What was your inspiration for this book and this setup? I'd love to hear about it.
Well, it was funny because I would say a fair amount of time I get an idea from a germ of something that happened to me, or I have sometimes seen the proverbial news headline. But in this case, as is true in a few cases, I just started having this thought and then I played with what if. And in this case, I was thinking about what if, you know, you know somebody was murdered and you're the only one who knows. And you're going to have to convince other people. But what if it was more complicated because it was your ex? And basically, people would think it's none of your business. you've ditched this person. You're not in the person's life anymore. And yet you feel an obligation because you cared about this person at one time. And so I just started playing with that idea.
Yeah. Oh, that's really interesting what you said about it's none of your business, because a lot of that tension or those obstacles came from people who were still, you know, part of the life of her ex being like, butt out, like you're just making things worse for us. You're just causing grief. So did you use that kind of to place more obstacles in front of your character as you went along?
Yeah, I realized as I started that would be a great way to create obstacles that are a little different than the usual ones that would come up when you're trying to get people, police, or anyone interested in the fact that it wasn't him taking his own life, it was murder. Mm-hmm. There are all these other people who just feel you have absolutely, you know, Kiki has absolutely no right to jump into this. So it created an additional series of obstacles for her.
Yeah. And so you said that you were just kind of were playing with this idea. So was it an inspiration that struck you, or just kind of those weird radio signals we get as writers from nowhere that we don't know where they come from? And then you just play with it.
I think it was just this weird thing of, I gave my commencement speech at my college 2 years ago. And I hadn't realized this, but somebody I used to date who was on the board now showed up to hear me speak. So I guess it just got me thinking a little bit about people who were once in your life and mattered to you and what role they play in your life still. And this person doesn't play any role, but I thought it was interesting that he came back to hear me speak and to see him again after so many years. And so I think that maybe was where the germ started. I actually find the whole idea of what if so great to work with. And sometimes when I'm teaching a writing class, which I don't do a lot of, but if I'm asked to speak like at the Writer's Digest or thriller writing conference, I talk about what if, and I sometimes worry people think, God, that is so basic and simple. And yet it really is great because you take your imagination off the leash and you just keep going and going and going. And I think it's important to do, even if you already have a plot point in mind. In fact, when I was talking to this class, I was giving the example of what if, and let's say I want to do a scene where a woman is going to meet somebody, a man in a hotel room, you know, and I know that much, but what if she gets there and he's never checked in as he was supposed to? Or what if she gets there and he's checked in, but he's nowhere in sight? Or what if she gets there and he's checked in and is nowhere in sight, but there's a smear of blood? But then I thought, what if she's walking down the street to the hotel and the hotel is going down in flames? So what if allows you to go maybe even farther than you planned to go originally?
Yeah, I think I love that. And like taking it to the end of the line, because that's when you really come up with your interesting ideas, right? Not just going with that first what if, but thinking of as many what ifs as you can until you get to something really interesting.
Right.
Yeah. And I think the interesting part is it works for every genre. I forget who I was talking to. It was another writer. And we were talking about the what ifs. And it's like with every genre, you know, if you're writing thriller, it's like, what if something thrilling happened? Or if you're writing horror, what if something horrible happened right now? Or comedy is, what if something hilarious happened? Fantasy, what if something magical happened? So you can just be thinking about all these real world situations in your genre. And that really can be a great germ for a story idea.
Yeah. And you bring up an interesting point. I think there are techniques in different genres that work nicely in others. I once was reading, because my books used to be reviewed by the Romantic Times, because there's often a relationship in them, but though they're not romances. But I happened to be reading the magazine because I'd gotten a fabulous review. And so I thought, well, I'm going to find out more about this. And there was a article by somebody who was a romance writer, and she was telling some of the strategies she used. And she, one of the things was, if you've got this great idea that you think will be great for the end of the book, towards the end of the book, move it up and then get another great idea. And I was writing a thriller then, and I just took something I planned for like the 28th chapter, and I just brought it forward. And it just meant there was something pretty dramatic happening much earlier than I had planned.
Yeah, that is a great one. And, you know, I've heard that, but I forgot about it. And I'm like, wow, I really should do that. But then you really have to push yourself when you're starting at your beginning, because then where do you go from there? You at the stakes?
Well, but you just do what if. Yeah. It's funny, when I was running Cosmopolitan, I worked with a great guy who was in charge of circulation. And we had actually worked together at the previous magazine in the company that I was editing called Redbook. And when I got there, this guy was so helpful to me. And I said to him, look, I've got some great Julia Roberts art that it doesn't have publicist approval. She's going to be really mad, and her publicist is going to be really mad when they find out I'm going to use it. So I'm thinking of maybe saving it to my sixth or seventh month in the job and just having this ace up my sleeve that I pull out. And he goes, no, don't keep your aces up your sleeve. Use it, because it'll do extraordinarily well. You'll have a really winning issue early in your tenure, and then you'll find something else. And it's interesting how I sometimes think that same philosophy has served me well in writing thrillers too. Just don't save your aces and just get another ace down the road.
Yeah, I think the pushing is the fun part, because you're like, now I have to come up with something even better. And I think it makes a better book. So I think that's a great tip. So I want to talk about a little bit about your main character in this book, Kiki, because as we said, like, her decision to investigate this death is personal. She's not a cop. She's not an investigator. She's kind of driven by guilt and disbelief and just determination in general. Can you talk a little bit about how you developed her character to make the journey compelling, as her just being some person investigating his death?
Right. Well, in my mystery series, the Bailey Wiggins books, she's a true crime writer. And so she acts a bit like a amateur sleuth. And you want to be careful when you're doing thrillers that you don't turn them into some amateur sleuth novel. But at the same time, when you are faced, as you are in most thrillers, with a threat or some setback, you have to start digging if you want to know the truth. And ultimately, the protagonist in a thriller is on the hero's mission, and ultimately she might be transformed somehow, but she's got to get from A to B and figure out the truth. And so that does take some digging. And I think today we are so good at using Google and doing things like that, that it's not unnatural for her to do some of that. There's one scene where she's trying to find out who owns these properties. And so she just Googles, you know, how do you find out who owns a piece of property? And so when I did that myself as part of my research for the book, I discovered that there are these services that do it, but you have to pay them. And I was a little wary about using a credit card.
Yeah.
And so I thought, what would she do? Kiki had spent a few years in working in human resources, and they do use people sometimes to do deep background research on people.
Right.
Because particularly today, you've got to know what somebody's been up to. So I thought, I bet she would know somebody that she could call up and say, hey, how do you do this? And in my case, I just used my financial planner, because he's a lawyer too. And I just called him and I said, hey, Elias, how do I do this? And he explained it's a little tricky, but he showed me how to do it. And so it just seemed very natural that she would do that. And there are other things that she begins to look into. There's a moment where a bunch of things begin to happen in the house she's staying at that she's like, whoa, these are freaking signs of a poltergeist. Yeah. And I don't believe in poltergeists. So I just Googled, you know, what are the signs that you have a ghost in your house? There, Christine, there are about 400,000 articles online.
I am sure, yeah.
So I think we all are amateur sleuths now in our daily life. So it isn't that hard for somebody to start doing a little digging and see where that will lead. And then, of course, that sets her on a path. And the more information she finds that makes her suspect that, my God, he was murdered, the deeper she has to dig then.
Yeah. And I love what you said. You know, I was doing the things that my character did, and this is how I think she would have felt about it. And I'm not giving my credit card. Who can I turn to? So you're kind of putting yourself in her shoes. And I'm interested in immersive writing. And I just wonder if there is anything else that you kind of do to get inside your characters' heads.
I actually do. I know Harlan Coben, who I really like. I said to him once, I know him and have been friendly with him and had dinner with him and his wife. But I've also interviewed him. And one time I remember him saying he thought research was another form of procrastination. And you could say that. But I love research. And because I also was a journalist, I find research interesting. And the great thing about research is that you often find, you discover stuff that becomes great plot points that you didn't know going into it. So I'm immersive that way, but I also really try to sit back sometimes and think, how's my character going to feel with this? And I read a great line the other day from Tanya French, the fabulous Tanya French. And she said something that a huge number of fiction teachers would say is, you just got to keep coming back to character. And I think you could be tempted as a thriller writer to get an idea like, okay, I'm going to make this happen and the character will do that. But it's important to immerse yourself enough to know, go, but what would she do? How would she react in that given situation? Maybe she won't do what you think the plot needs, mm-hmm. but you want to be true to the character. I had this funny thing happen. I'm almost embarrassed to admit it, but no one will hear this other than you and me, right, Christine?
Right, exactly.
We live in Uruguay, as I know you know, during the winter. And one day I walked into the bathroom and I was looking for the deodorant. I said to my husband, "Hey, where's the deodorant?" And he goes, "Cater, you are not using my deodorant anymore. You are too messy with it. I am not going to let you use my deodorant. You're going to have to get your own." I'm like, "What?" Well, as soon as he was gone, I immediately began searching for the deodorant. I thought, "I am not going to be undone by this. I am going to get the deodorant." And I looked every place. I looked in the cabins, the bathroom. I looked in our bedroom. I looked in his home office, which is on the second floor of our house. Nothing. Well, a couple weeks later, I was brushing my teeth, and in our bathroom in Uruguay, the bathroom that we use upstairs, there's a counter with the bowl is the sink is like a white ceramic bowl sitting on top, and I drop my toothbrush, and as I run to grab it from at the back of the bowl, I find. It's been an inch away from me the whole time. But what was really interesting, I thought, my husband is one of the most expedient people I know. He would never have hidden it in his office. He would never hid in our closet. He would always have hidden it inches away. And I thought it was such a great lesson for me. Come back to character. And so I try to immerse myself in stuff that way. And sometimes, even with my husband, because some of my characters have been married, not always to perfect men, or they might be seeing somebody, not all of them. I'll sometimes ask my husband, just talk to me about this right now. And don't worry about saying anything. Let me just get in the mood. And it's a little crazy, but I find it helps. When I visited Charles Dickens' house in London, I remember reading that he would act out scenes from his books. Not that I'm comparing myself to Charles Dickens.
No, I do find that helps though, and there's something strange about it because I do this to my poor husband too. I was talking about this, and I was like, "Oh, I'm stuck on this. I need help with this problem. I don't know. Maybe you can read this chapter and then tell me where to go." And I sent it to him, and then I was like, "Never mind. I figured it out." Like just the
Right.
action of talking to someone about it, sometimes you solve your own problem. So,
It
yeah.
sparks. Are you a big researcher?
Sometimes it depends what I'm doing. Yeah. Yeah,
And do you ever
definitely
you
does.
do what if as well?
Oh, yeah. What if is my
Good.
favorite? That's what I usually do when I get stuck, and I'll write it down about 12. It could be this. And it's usually somewhere between number 10 to 12 that is the thing I should do.
You know what else is to you make me think of this when you said writing it down. Years ago, I was at a media conference that my company sponsored. It was really fabulous. And they had a lot of interesting speakers. And one was this woman who'd written a book called Practical Intuition. Her name is Laura Day. And the book was really, I guess, kind of woo-woo in some regards. But one of the things she said is that when you want the answer to something creative, you ask the question of the universe. And it's not like the universe is going to go, "She should kill him in the third chapter," or something like that. But you then prime your subconscious to be open. And so when I start a new book, or even if I keep a notebook all through a book, I am often writing down questions like, why would she know that? What happens that makes her know that? And even sometimes as I'm writing the question, it's amazing the answer appears in front of my eyes, and it's just you're putting it out to the universe somehow.
Yeah, you're just working the problem, even though you don't really realize you're working the problem. Yeah. So you do, I want to ask a couple questions. So you said you like to research. What about with setting? How did you decide on this setting for the book? Have you been to rural Connecticut? Is that something you're familiar with?
Yes, my son lives there. In fact, my kids are really great about reading my books when they come out, and they're just such good fans. And my son was like, "Mom, when am I going to get a copy of the book?" And I hope he's not going to go, "Whoa, she took a lot from rural Connecticut here." It's a very charming part of Connecticut. There are a lot of New Yorkers who live there that have weekend homes as in addition to just people who are there year round. And that's fairly typical of me. I don't like to write about something I've never been to and or I've just been to once. During the pandemic, I did have to do all online research and interview real estate agents about a place. And I didn't go there. And it's funny because one of my brothers had, and he said, "Oh, Cater, I love the way you captured such and such." So I felt kind of guilty. And so today with you can get video of all sorts of streets and so much. And yet for me, it's better if I go.
If you
I
go.
just, but I don't fault anyone who doesn't go, but it's better for me if I go.
Yeah, I thought the setting was really interesting just in the way it heightened tension because she's not from there. She's renting all these houses. She's kind of familiar with it, but kind of not.
Right,
It's kind of
right.
isolated, but kind of not. And people are like watching her, but there's also these chances for isolation. Did you think about that in terms of how you're going
Yeah,
to use the setting to heighten tension?
because I
Yeah.
figured in the house that she's renting as an Airbnb, there's one house on one side that she never sees anybody in, and so you just sort of have the sense of there maybe a little bit of foreboding because she
Yeah.
doesn't know anyone. There's no one she could call and just ask. And the night she's driving home and she realizes someone's following her, I have felt sometimes a little spooky. It'd be a little spooky there. My son doesn't feel that way, but as I've been on roads there, you're always careful about deer and bear and it's very similar actually to where we have a weekend home in Pennsylvania, where it's very much the same feeling. And I used a little bit of that as well.
Yeah. So I thought that was interesting. And you do your great character depth, but then your books read so darn fast. I read a lot of books for the podcast. I'm like, this book reads really, really fast. And I don't know why. I was trying to figure it out. So tell us your secrets. Why do your books read so fast?
Well, I'm a pretty big editor, and part of what I'm trying to do is speed it up
Yeah.
because I would probably, my tendency is to want to do a fair amount of metaphors and similes and more setting description, but more and more readers who read thrillers say that they don't want to get bogged down in that. And you look at like a James Patterson book, I don't think you even know the eye color of some of the people in his books.
Yeah, that's totally true.
So the book I just finished, I do have more of that in there, but the character's older, and so I see the book maybe for maybe a slightly older reader, and my agent really likes it. So I like a bit of that myself, and I like that as a reader. But even still, sometimes towards the end of a book, I'm just tearing through it to
Yeah.
find out what's going on.
Yeah, I was kind of envious because I think I read that book in 2 days and I'm not the fastest reader. And I'm like, I think that's the fastest book I've read in a long time. And it's the same page count. So why did it read so fast? Yeah, I think it's just what you're saying. You're not putting any kind of filler in, you're editing it so that it tears through. It did tear. So it's a good lesson in that.
I have to ask you a question. Have you found yourself as a thriller and mystery reader, among other books you read, that there some of them are getting so absurd now today that or do you feel like that's what people want? Like there was a book I read not long ago where there wasn't just one serial killer, there were two, and I was like, wow, the odds of that have to be pretty darn great.
Well, I wonder if it's just because, readers are so astute now. They're really keen. They can predict things that are coming. They know what twists are coming.
Yeah.
So it's hard to stay ahead of the readers. They read so much, they watch so much Netflix, they've seen everything.
Right,
But I
right.
think people are just trying to find ways to stay ahead of their readers,
I know it is a challenge. I just reread and rewatched Green for Danger. Have you ever read
I
that book?
haven't, no.
It's from the 40s and it's considered one of the great British mysteries, and it's a great movie too. And it all takes place in a hospital setting during the war. And one of the things I love about it, there are only five suspects. And it kind of brought me back to the idea of maybe it doesn't, things like I've read a couple locked room mysteries in the last few years where I could not keep track of all the characters. And I thought maybe there's a way to get back to doing things that aren't so convoluted, that you want to surprise your reader, but you're not taking them into this crazyville with so many bizarre twists and
Yeah,
stuff.
I think it's a difficult thing to pull off, and I'm going to quote someone without attribution because I forget who said it, that what you're trying to do as a writer is to do a simple story well told. So
Yeah, right.
I know that's it's but it's hard to do with such sophisticated readers. So I don't know, what do you have strategies for, like, planting red herrings and clues without making the mystery too convoluted or too obvious?
Well, what I do try to do is really plot in advance. And I think that helps you know where you're going to lay down your clues and your red herrings both, because I like to know that I missed a clue and slap myself in the head. That's one thing I never liked about P.D. James. She did not leave clues. You would find this moment at the end where it's like, oh, it turns out that's the illegitimate child. Whereas I love Ruth Rendell's Inspector Wexford series because the clues are there if you're smart enough. And I never was smart enough to
No,
get
I
to
love
one
that
of
retroactive aha, though. That's like, you're like,
Yeah.
oh man, yeah, it is such a great experience as a reader.
And I don't fully plot. I always know the inciting incident and maybe the hook. I know the big reveal. I know the killer. But that means that I've got an idea before I start of what misdirection I'm going to do.
Yeah.
When I have a bunch of wonderful friends who are mystery authors who, in addition to ones who plot, who don't plot, but I wonder how do they do it without finding, as they're getting towards the end, I haven't done enough clues. I've done some
Yeah.
red herrings, but not enough clues.
I guess that's what maybe editing is for. I don't know. I'm a plotter, so I don't know how they do it either, but I'm
But I'm so
envious.
I expected as much. Yes, right.
Oh my goodness. And we're just running out of time. So, yeah, thanks for coming on. I'd just love to hear about any hints on what you're working on next. Are you going to be kind of exploring similar themes, diving into new territories? What's next for you?
Well, I'm going to be out on the road with The Last Time She Saw Him promoting that and just finishing sending to my agent. She's read most of it in a couple weeks, the book I'm just working on. And just, I think, as you said so well, Christine, trying to figure out ways to be fair to the reader, but stay ahead of them enough because it's such a glutted market and people read so many thrillers. You've got to bring something very fresh to the game.
Okay. So Kate said, don't keep your aces up your sleeves.
I agree.
Start right out with them. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree with that 100%.
Yeah, I do too. Even if,
Why wait?
yeah, because like I've got a list of books that I want to write. There's some good ones on there, and originally, almost plot it out. Like, I want to write this one first and this one, because this one will play off of that one. And like, nah, just throw the best that you've got out there. One of the techniques that I've seen people do, like a lot of times, if you've got just story beats, you know, essentially these aces are story beats, you know, write them down in index cards and just, you know, randomly mix them up and see what order they come out in. And a lot of times it may spark a totally different direction in your story than what you would have thought, you know, taking it out of an organic, you know, this happens to this happens to this happens, you know, A, B, C leads to D. When you shake that up, a lot of times it's a much better story.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think there's like a tendency to feel like either afraid that you may never have another idea again, or like, and I know, you know, I'll hear sometimes from newer writers like, well, I'm going to query this one, but I'm going to wait until I have, you know, an agent, an editor before I present this idea because I think it's really good. And it's like, well, why don't you try to debut with that? Like, I mean,
exactly. Yeah. I'll go a little woo with it if you don't mind, but I read Elizabeth Gilbert's book, Big Magic. And she had this whole philosophy of like, ideas come along, they're for you until, unless you decide or unless you don't act on them, and then they go find the person they are for. And
I agree with that.
I think that's exactly what happens. And also, why wouldn't you want to present like your very best ideas to an agent or editor, or, you know, an audience? Like, why wouldn't you want to do the very best? And ideas breed more ideas. Like, once you've written that book, you'll get feedback, you'll get some random thing. Yeah. Someone will say or do something and you'll be like, that's the perfect follow-up to my book. And then, you know, ideas just breed more ideas.
They do.
So talking about woo, Kevin, do you put your ideas out to the universe?
Tell me what you mean by that, and I'll give you.
So Kate said, you know, she'll write it down in a journal or whatever, just get the idea out there, and then
I don't do that.
The idea will solve itself.
I thought that's what you. So no, I don't. I will not write down an idea that way, because my approach is like, you know how you wake up in the middle of the night with a great idea, and everyone's like, you know, write it down. I won't do that because what I think happens for me is that there's a filter. So if the idea really is that good, it's going to come back to me and, or it's going to stick around and bug me until I write it. But if it's something that, cause I've tried the approach in the past of like, I woke up with a brilliant idea or a scene or whatever, and I, you know, wrote it down, and the next morning it made no sense whatsoever. It was written in Greek, or if it was translatable, it really wasn't as good an idea as I thought. And so what I do is I get excited about that. I let that kind of hit me, and then I see if it sticks over the course of, you know, the next few days as I take showers or walks or whatever. If I find myself coming back to it, then I won't jot it down. I will create from it.
Yeah, I do the same thing, but I do, I guess, put things out, not to the universe, usually to my husband when I'm stuck on something. And just talking about it, he doesn't even need to say anything. I usually solve it myself. Yeah. So it's just by, I don't know, the act of talking. I'm like, oh, this is my problem. And then usually before he's even opened his mouth, I'm like, never mind, I've solved it. So I do that.
I definitely don't tell Kara my ideas because that goes wrong every time. Because she gets excited about an idea and she runs in her own direction with it. And if I don't write that book, we're headed for divorce. So I don't tell her any of that.
Well, luckily now you can just tell the AI, right? You can have that conversation with the AI.
Now I can tell the AI.
Yeah.
I write things down. I keep them. Sometimes it's just like a sentence or a scene, and sometimes it's for something I'm working on or just something that I'm like, oh, that's interesting, and I'll just kind of put a pin in it. Because you just never know when you're going to like get stuck and you're going to need something. And so you just kind of like flip through it and then you go like, oh, that would be the perfect solution for here. And then I also think it helps me feel like I'm not procrastinating sometimes. If I'm really stuck on what I'm working on, I'll kind of go to like a book idea and just sort of tinker with like, well, what would this character do? And what would this character be? And just kind of let that. And then usually that will trigger something else over here. And so I kind of use them to play off each other and to just stay in a creative mode. Even if I'm stuck on one project, I still have multiple things that I can be creative about. And that seems to work pretty well for me.
Yeah. I liked how Kate was talking about immersive writing. I'm always interested in how writers do this, how they immerse themselves in their books. And she talked about, you know, you keep coming back to character. You have to know how your characters would react. And then talked a bit about acting out scenes from the book. Have you ever acted out a scene from your book?
I don't know if I've ever acted them out. I have gone through the mechanics of fight scenes before, but I am lucky. I have friends who train in MMA. So I will ask them, you know, if I have a character that does this, how would they get out of this? And because I'm like a very visual kinesthetic learner, like we'll go through like the slow motion, you know, moves so that I can really understand like where it would be. Not that I'm putting that all on paper, but it just helps me like understand where an arm would be, where a foot would be. So I will do that. And I do sometimes talk out the dialogue to make sure it sounds normal.
The only scenes that I act out are when the characters are drinking coffee or bourbon.
I think dialogue's important, right? At least say it out loud or get something to read it to you. I have author friends that have those little wooden statues that you can get like at art stores of people, you know, like the human frame, you know, to kind of help them plot out fight scenes. Because that can be tricky, especially if you're trying to get real intricate with it.
Yeah, it does. It's very helpful because usually I'm like, you know, just the little things of like, how would they get out of this in a realistic way? And I have to see it to understand it. So being able to go through it, and then I learn fight moves. So, you know, I am becoming a deadly weapon, as with every book I write.
Yeah. I have watched training videos on YouTube too, like military training, and that's very informative when you need to know how something would go down.
Does that count as acting it out? I mean, because I do that.
I don't know. Probably not.
That's sort of a rehearsal.
I don't actually act it out.
Yeah.
I don't, you know, grab my cat and be like, let's go. You
know? Well, now I want you to do that.
I'm still thinking about the AI stuff. So, like, what if you took one of those fight videos and you showed it to the AI? Could the AI give you the text to actually describe it?
Interesting. Interesting.
That would be very interesting. Well, maybe now it can.
I feel Kevin needs to try that because I'm too lazy to actually.
I will probably try that now.
Try that report back. Thank
you. I will tell you this. I mean, I've used AI to generate certain descriptions and things before, and they're almost always terrible. But it's just like using it to bounce ideas. It's like the idea is terrible, but it is a starting point. Basically, it's kind of like knowing what not to do. And then because of that, I can figure it out and I come up with my own thing. So
the other thing I thought was interesting that Kate talked about, because I read that book and, you know, I read a lot of books for this podcast and her book read super fast. And I'm like, why is this book that's the same length as other books reading so fast? And she said, get rid of metaphors, similes, and setting, which I was like, fair enough. I don't know. Do you have thoughts on that? How to make books read faster?
I mean, you can definitely trip. What were her chapters like? Were they short?
I think I would probably say they're probably average for a thriller. I would guess like 1,500, 2,000 words probably. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, because working with Patterson, like he just drilled this into my head. Like my chapters were anywhere from like 1,000 to like maybe 1,200 words. So they're short. Paragraphs are short. Sentences are short. Like everything is short. And like the more white space you put on the page, the faster you end up flipping those pages. And you use that, you know, so when you want to slow the story down, you want to slow the reader down, you go in the opposite direction and give them a big block of text versus that. So there's a lot of little tips and tricks you can do there to speed things up.
I like to, I think of it like, if you were going to cross a river, it's easier to cross a river if you have little stones you can jump from, you know, to and from. That's what I'm doing with scenes. So, you know, I get everyone who reads my stuff tends to tell me that it was fast paced and they really enjoyed it. And that's the point of me writing a thriller. And that's one of the things I do. I prefer to read that way. When I have to read a book that's like this chapter is 50 pages long, I'm filled with dread the whole way through. But if it's like, okay, there's three pages and then a scene break and then, you know, another three pages, like I could read, you know, 1,000 pages over a weekend if you do it that way. But I feel intimidated by the, like JD said, like the block of text.
Well, it does. I think that there's like some, and I'm sure Christine can talk about this, but I'm sure there's some neurology to it of just like, you know, when you're looking at the actual page and like you look at a lot of dense text and that's like, you know, your brain kind of has to filter out all that text while you focus on each individual line, which is work, you know, it takes more of your capacity and your attention and focus. Whereas you have that white space, it's not working as hard. So you can really just zoom in and read faster. My amateur neurology would tell me that this is true.
Yeah, that's right on, right? It's just processing.
Neurology or neuroses?
Well, yeah, when I'm working with kiddos who get overwhelmed by a lot of text when we're doing assessments, I just literally take a blank page and cover it up. So they only have to look at one sentence at a time and then we move it down. So, yeah, it definitely is.
Yeah.
Does trick you. You know, when you see more white space,
yeah,
you don't feel so overwhelmed.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever the pathways are that work on that, there's my real
explanation. It's like taking a breath when you're talking. It's like if you find yourself talking too fast or whatever, and that pause to take a breath kind of lets your brain have a moment to kind of run up, catch up, and then you can continue on.
So this is something we talk a lot about, and it's such a tricky thing. How do you keep a book fresh while staying fair to the reader? How do you keep it?
I use Ziploc bags and desiccate. Keep it in the fridge.
No. But how do you make your story like simple and well told, but not something they can guess with sophisticated readers? That is a really tricky thing to do. I don't know if there's an answer to that, but it's just like, I guess that's the whole point, right?
Yeah, I don't know that there is either. I mean, like even when I watch TV shows, you know, like they're getting to the point where like they're getting very easy to guess. I think certain things are formulaic, and like I know when I write, like if I feel like I'm going in a direction that the story feels like it should go, then I purposely go off in another direction. Like I'll force myself to do something different, and I think that kind of keeps it fresh to a certain extent. But yeah, that's tricky, and you know, especially if you write genre, you know, like thriller readers read a lot of thrillers, they tend to follow the same formula, so it gets harder and harder to fool those people.
I think if you stick with character, that may be like a little bit of the answer, because if you really get like, you know, imagine people, like there's, I don't even know how many, 8 billion people on the planet at this point, maybe more. And, you know, while people may be similar and you can like, you know, get along with them and understand them, like they are still very unique and have, you know, unique personalities and think uniquely and will, you know, put 5 people in a room and they'll all look at the same problem differently. And I think you can have very similar plots, but when you really hone in on character and bring that character to life with all their quirks and individual personalities, then you're offering the reader something new, because that's a character, that's a personality, that's a person doing something that only they are going to be able to do in a way. So I think that's probably when I heard her say that and I thought about what I really like about books, it really did come down to, you know, oh, well, I just really enjoyed the characters and how they went through the plot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, part of the key too is not to get too cute just to put in a surprise, right? Like it has to make sense.
It's got to be organic.
Story,
so. Yeah. But Mike, I agree with Jenna though, because my characters are really, they're the boss in this whole thing. Like they really, they're bullies a lot of time. Like they just, I'm afraid of most of them, but they will do some random thing, say some random thing. One of them decides, hey, I'm just going to be murdered right now or whatever. And now I have to write the rest of that story. I wasn't expecting that. And, you know, so that helps a lot. So I don't know, but we may be back to neuroses again for that one. I may have that.
Well, I think that's fabulous. A common writer problem.
Oh. And now that we've all admitted we have neuroses, JD, who's up next week?
Next week, we've got Michael Jamin coming on. Michael's a professional TV writer and showrunner for over 27 years. He's got credits including King of the Hill, Beavis and Butthead, Just Shoot Me, and many others. He's going to be here to talk about his new book, A Paper Orchestra, which is a collection of essays detailing his time in Hollywood. That one's going to be fun.
Yeah, fantastic. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers, Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.